Welcome to this installment of Bookbinding Now, a podcast series initiated by Susan Mills. Today we are speaking with Chicagoland book artist Karen Hanmer. Karen's work uses text and images to intertwine cultural and personal memory. The work is often playful in structure and content and often includes social commentary. Although she began by making largely photo-based artist books, she moved into the realm of traditional fine binding and is working towards her certificate from the American Academy of Bookbinding. Concurrently, she also teaches a wide range of structures and techniques actively on the workshop circuit and is sought after as a speaker. Her work is included in collections ranging from Tate Britain and the Library of Congress to Syracuse University and Graceland. In 2009, she won the DeGaulier Jury Prize for binding. Karen Hanmer curated the Guild of Bookworkers Marking Time exhibition and serves on the editorial board of the Bone Folder. She lives online at karenhanmer.com. Karen, we've known each other since we met at the Guild Standard Conference in Chicago. That was back in 1999. And since that time, I've really enjoyed our ongoing dialogue in which you help me understand artists' books. I've also really enjoyed working with you on the Guild exhibits and the Bone Folder. Can you tell me a little bit about your background and how you became involved in the book arts?
Sure. But first of all, thanks for interviewing me. This is going to be fun. I've been looking forward to it. And that was a nice introduction. So I started doing photography in high school and kept on through college and beyond, though it's not something I studied in school. I studied economics. And I became frustrated with photography, so I wanted to do something more tactile with the photography. So I tried coating my own paper, graph paper, sandpaper, something to get my hands in what I was doing more. I did some self-portraits. I worked with pinhole because it seemed like I was, with a more primitive camera, it seemed like I was more involved in the process. But none of that was terribly satisfying. I wasn't a great photographer. I would say I was a pretty mediocre photographer. I don't know if I realized how mediocre at that point. But I started going to a lot more exhibits and looking at things other than photography, and also seeing photography that was presented in three-dimensional ways rather than just things incarcerated in a frame on a series of them marching down a wall. And I wanted to make something that combined text and image and would stand these little hinged panels that were kind of like case-bound books but without the text block in. So someone told me I needed to study with a bookbinder to learn how to do that. And after making a few calls, I ended up studying with Scott Keller, who didn't take beginners at that point, but I guess I was really persuasive, and I told him I need to learn how to make this particular thing, and then if it doesn't work out, I'll go away. But that was 1997, and I did not go away yet, and he has not asked me to go away. So, after making these three-dimensional things that allowed me to become physical involved, were tactile for me, plus the viewer, so much more opportunity for viewer involvement, the ability to, if the piece was successful, draw the viewer in. Once you have a book in your hands and you're looking at it, I don't think it's so easy to just get up and leave as if you're standing in a gallery looking at a bunch of stuff on the wall. It's pretty easy to just turn or stop looking. Anyway, the rest is history. For many years now, I only use my camera to photograph my books for PR reasons.
Right. You became most well known for your photographic flag books and similar structures, mostly accordion based. What attracted you to those?
Early on, I took some workshops at Columbia College, In those days, the graduate program had few enough people in it that members of the community could take the classes along with the grad students. And I must have gone on a field trip to the Joan Flash Collection at the School of the Art Institute, and I saw Susan King's Women and Cars, which is a flag book from sometime in the 80s. And it was inspiring to me how it layered all the elements. There was this vintage photograph. There were personal stories about, I guess, some relatives of Susan's, and then some historical text also. And it was very inspiring to me to be able to weave all these elements together. And I probably wasn't, at that time, it probably could have gone either way, whether I would have continued making books or not. And I'm sure that seeing that book that was so inspirational to me helped me continue making books instead of going back to being a mediocre photographer.
A lot of your work is commentary on social and political issues, and most recently, you've started using classic texts like Sloan's The Model Architect or some of Poe's stories as a foundation for your work. What attracts you to doing the social and the political commentary?
That all started, maybe 2002. I can't remember the date, but I will say that the previous administration, the previous president, was very inspirational to me. So the first thing I made, and that if you want to lump all that into a series, would be Patriot Alphabet. I needed to make an alphabet book as part of a annual service project for the now defunct Chicago Hand Bookbinders. So A, Axis of Evil, B, Dirty Bomb, C, Enemy Combatant, D, Detainee, and so on. I don't know, it was on my mind and I needed to make a book, and it just kind of seemed obvious what to do. And then was able to use the same text, expand upon that, and use it over and over again. As far as the historical books, so Patriot Alphabet was made in response to a particular project that I had to do. The Model Architect, using Samuel Sloan's 1852 book of house plans, was put online with a number of other books of mid-19th century landscape and architectural design. So there were, the Philadelphia Athenaeum put these historical books of landscape and architectural design online, and the project was to come up with a new work in response to one of these books. So I saw this book of grandiose house plans, and it just seemed obvious to me that linked up with all these grandiose houses that were teardowns of modest houses on my street, and they were now in foreclosure. The day I got that idea was the day that the house next door that had been vacant for months, no electricity, no gas, and a basement full of water, because it's swampy here and you need a sump pump. The day I got the idea, somebody came to pump the 8 feet of water out of the basement and cut the grass that was 4 feet high over there. So it's just a response to what I see going on in my life. The next book that I did that responds to some historical book, a friend here in Chicago, Sean Sheehy, was curating a show of Halloween-themed books, and I'd done a binding, a commission binding of a Poe story, and had read a bunch of Poe, kind of his research, or to get in the mood, and was aware of some similarities between Poe's stories and current events, so I took the opportunity of needing to come up with a Halloween-themed work by putting together the Poe stories and what was going on. For instance, the premature burial in our economy that's just kind of hanging on. There was a story that seemed to me to speak to the erosion of civil liberties since 9/11. There was one about a guy that went off hiking in the mountains in the southeast and came back with a fantastic story that seems so much like Governor Sanford. So, I don't know, it was fun.
Do you find that you get a different response from collectors of your work to the more structurally creative visual books than you do to the ones that are more commentaries?
That's an interesting question, something I've been thinking about lately. Those latest two, there's a lot of stuff to read, especially the Poe. There's really no image to it at all. I base the layout and the type on this 1827 first edition of Poe's first published work, so it's not like there's nothing to see, but it's not a bunch of triangles or some funny shape, or it doesn't spin or make noise or anything. And I don't really do market research to see what somebody wants before I make things. And I don't know what all the different collections collect, but I know that they do sometimes like these more I hate to say more creative, because right, doing something interesting with a codex is creative also. But if, for instance, if my dealer, Vamp and Tramp, in Birmingham, Alabama, Bill and Vicki Stewart, if they take 50 books to some collection, lay them out on tables, which one's going to get noticed in a limited amount of time? The flamboyant one or the one that you have to pick up and read a whole bunch of stuff? I don't know.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting question. And it kind of ties into my next thought is, I mean, in recent years, let's say the past 8 or so, I've sensed that you're moving more and more into the realm of traditional fine binding. You're exhibiting more traditional bindings in shows. You're working towards your certificate. Your work is changing, even though you're still holding on a lot to the more, what I like to call, freaky foldy side of things. Part, what motivated you to move into this more traditional realm, and do you find that your work in artist books has informed your fine binding and vice versa?
I'd say my work in artist books, being able to do that helps me come up with the designs for the bindings. A lot of binders have said to me, I think you've said to me, that the design part is the hardest part.
Oh, it's awful.
And, you know, for me, it's just obvious. When I get my idea for the design, I still refine it, and the thing I'm binding right now, every time I make a significant change in the design, I print it out, and I just print it out number 22. So I still have to work at them, but once I come up with the idea for design, it seems so obvious that I can't believe that all the other 30 or 50 or whatever people who are in the competition aren't going to have the exact same thing. You know, it just becomes so clear that that's what it has to be. And that part comes easily. As far as the binding informing what I'm doing with artist books, yeah, they've become a lot more codexy over the past few years. And some of the binding stuff is your influence. When we got to be friends and didn't know each other that well and didn't, you know, talk about the whole range of things friends
right,
talk about, we'd talk about binding. And that's when the bone folder started having the binderamas, you know. So for the millimeter one and the springback one, the first two, I made, like, 3 each of those.
And right, and the springback one, I remember being a dose of dough a dough.
Yeah.
Which was a trip.
And it's very large and heavy. The artist books, mine generally, since I never did make them out of branches and stuff I found outside and so forth, they fold up quite small. I'm starting to have a storage issue.
Right.
With all these bindings, and the Do-Si-Do sure takes up a lot of space. So my artist books are getting more codexy. I'm more interested in the history of the book now.
And that's something that showed, especially in your Poe binding.
Right. Yeah. Jeff Peachy taught this workshop on this pre-industrial revolution mass-produced kind of binding, this early publisher's binding, and it's just the antithesis of what I'm learning in the study with Monique Lallier. You make saw marks instead of punching for the signatures. You casually lace them in. You just
you
get
don't
some
worry
paste.
About lumps and bumps.
Right. And without benefit of waste paper, in 15 minutes, the whole thing is bound instead of like in 2 weeks and sanding and closing your eyes and feeling for blemishes and hoping there'll be some so you can sand some more. There's this thing that you can make in 15 minutes. And I thought, well, that's great. I absolutely have to have my next edition be this thing of Jeff because it's such relief to be able to work this way also. And fortunately, the next thing I did needed to be early 19th century. So it worked. Another thing that has influenced what my work is now, being more codexy, would be during the 100th anniversary show for the Guild that we kind of worked on together. And
that's
a lot
true.
Of, there was that category of edition binding, which is something that just doing what I do was not on my radar because I don't do work for other people. I'd be open to it, but people.
But your work is
generally.
But your work is generally editioned.
It's editioned, but I just never thought about how there's people out there that are making 50, 150, 200 of something identical. And not a lot of creative input. They're just making this stuff and doing it as efficiently as possible, making things in bulk. And it was just really intriguing. So I have kind of been, I'm making decisions about how can I make a whole bunch of these efficiently.
How do you determine edition size, and how do you manage the process in terms of workflow and the steps? Do you make all the items of an edition at once? Do you break it into smaller chunks?
Yeah, my edition size used to just be theoretical because my work wasn't selling. Now that it is, I used to say that my edition size would be 20, and now I've bumped it up a little bit, but I still don't sell them that quickly. I've sold out very few things. So I'll make all my prototypes, and I make a lot of prototypes when I'm working on something, like those triangular books about the night sky. I probably made 25 or 30 of those. The model architect, even though it was just a drum leaf binding here, I was tinkering with the contents. There were probably 8 or 9 of those. So when I get one everything is completely resolved, then I mark that's my final model. Then I'll make, depending on how complicated it is, I'll make maybe, I don't know, 4 more, so I have a couple that can be sold, and then the first 2 will be marked display copies, so they
right.
can make the shows, because I don't think if somebody's paying for something, they should get something that's been manhandled. And then I'll see how it goes, and I'll make them in batches when those 2 are gone, I'll make another batch. And if it's a complicated thing, maybe I'll just make a couple. Or if it's simple, like the red pamphlet with the random passions with the people from the romance novel covers,
right.
I can make a dozen of those at once. Or Mirage, the drum leaf is small in size. But the model architect is so big, large page size. I did 8 at a time, and that was just too much. I was confused with what I was doing. So I guess by the time I've made all those prototypes, I kind of have a feel for how many I can make at once. And I don't make all 30 because they don't sell that quickly, and where would I keep them? And it's not good for my self-esteem to have thousands of unsold books clogging my studio, and it's probably a health hazard. Does that answer your question, Peter?
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
As an established book artist, you've talked about not selling work or selling it in smaller quantities. How do you describe the challenges of marketing your work in both disciplines, the traditional binding as well as the artist books? What kinds of strategies do you use? Do they work?
As far as the bindings, I have not figured out how to sell them yet.
But they seem to sell themselves.
Well, the last several years, one or two a year, so it's starting to happen. I guess I kind of thought by the time I got good, I would have figured out how to do it. But I've become pretty competent at making the stuff, but don't feel that I've come pretty competent at knowing how to sell them. But the artist books, of course, I always wish that it would be more, but I kind of have my routine with that. I've kept a mailing list for a long time, even before I was doing books. From when I was doing photography and I'd exhibit, I had my mailing list for my exhibit announcements. So it was just a natural extension of that to start adding special collections librarians to the list. It took me a while to figure out what the changes I had to make and what I sent out. So now I send out, I guess if I was a fine press person, I'd call it a prospectus. I guess it is a prospectus.
Sure.
It is a prospectus. It's
right.
This postcard with some photographs of the piece. I've been lately getting someone to write a little essay about the piece. I'm running out of people that I know well enough that I can ask to do this for me who will be glad to do it, to have some name recognition. So that's going to start being an issue. But I get a little paragraph or two written about the piece by someone, information about the piece, my little statement about it, how much it costs, and how to contact me. At first, I didn't say how much it costs because it seemed kind of salesy, but then
right.
That is what I'm trying to do, isn't it?
Right.
And the feedback I've gotten from special collections librarians is give us all the information we need, because there's certainly a lot of people out there trying to sell work and budgets are limited, so I want to make it as easy as possible for somebody to pick me if they're interested in picking mine. So I send this thing out to my mailing list at least once a year, maybe twice if there's a reason, if there's a new book or something. And it was not very effective at all until I started sending out a follow-up email to people. That's been very helpful. And that's a personalized email. I tried it at the beginning of the year, and it wasn't a personalized email. It was just BCC to everybody and, like, dear occupant, I sent you this mailing. What do you think? And that was not effective at all. But who knows if it was... If it was the time of year, the economy, where they were in the budget cycle, I still have a lot to figure out,
yeah.
I feel like.
Do you find that there's a difference in terms of response and amount of sales when you directly go out there and try to market your work, or when you're working with, let's say, Vamp and Tramp?
I get sales from both, and what I've been doing for the past several years is I try to do it first, I don't know, for a year, for 6 months, for a couple months. Maybe I'll have an introductory price that's a little lower, and then I'll raise the price a little bit when I give it to the dealer, because the dealer takes 40%.
Right.
So I need to build that price in. So I really can't compare. I think it takes both. You know, it takes a village thing. Well, it takes a village to sell an artist book, too. What I've noticed in the last couple of years is I'll send my mailing out, and there might be a bump in sales from the dealer when I send my mailing out.
Okay.
They have a lot of paperwork to do to buy something from an individual, and it seems that more and more of the institutions just want to buy from the dealers.
Right.
It's great to have the dealer, because I couldn't possibly go to all those places. It's costly to do that travel, and I would have to charge even more if I was going to build in the cost of all these sales calls.
Right.
If I were to take my work around the country. But they represent numerous people, so my work won't be shown everywhere where they go. So I think it takes a combination of my efforts and their efforts.
Okay. How do you judge the impact of exhibiting your work on sales?
It could be another opportunity for a collection to see the work. And almost all my sales are to collections, not to individuals, though I'm certainly grateful when an individual buys them. So for the show to have impact, it would, maybe the show is somewhere where they have a collection and they're buying. Maybe there's a catalog. The show would have to be well publicized, and if there's a catalog, some effort going to market the catalog, just, you know, the line on the resume,
right,
doesn't do it. A traveling show would be good. You know, they often, the traveling shows go to a lot of university libraries, and that's who buys my work. Do a lot of people see the exhibits when they're at university libraries? I don't know.
You know, that's one of those things that's really hard to judge, and I definitely do agree with you that the venues really need to promote the show and the catalogs when they are hosting things, and I'm not sure that's always happening. And it's a challenge. It's an ongoing challenge. In terms of your work, what do you feel are the two most successful pieces you've created, and why do you think they're more successful than some of the other ones?
Did you say the two most?
Yeah, one or two.
Well, I'm still pretty much in love with the Poe, though it's the latest one. And it's different because I've never done so much writing myself before. I've usually just taken some historical document or when I was doing more personal work, maybe things that relatives had said, or just little snippets of something I wrote. So I wrote a lot for that one, but I'm really happy with the way I was able to integrate current events into the Poe stories. They seem to work really well to me. I guess I'm not the best judge of that.
Well, as an owner of one of the copies, I can say, I mean, it reads very well, and the juxtaposition between the Poe style, the tales, and the current events that are being recast in a Poe-esque way, I think works really well.
And I don't remember, do you have the deluxe or the standard? Do you have the...
All three.
You have all of them. Thank you very much.
I don't usually do that, but this was, at least from my perspective, I really enjoy the work, and it's also very, since a lot of the things that I collect, I show to students, it's nice to show the three different versions of that work and let people think about what are the differences between them, why might someone do one or the other or all of them.
Well, a few things that are satisfying about that to me. I feel like I was able to really use my liberal arts education to weave together the current events, the historical context of the Poe stories and the literature itself in the Poe stories to write all that. I was able to use some of my history of the book. I've been trying to learn. The standard edition is based on a significant book. It's Poe's 1827 Tamerlane and Other Poems, the first edition of his first published work. So there's maybe only 60 printed, 50 or 60, only 12 known in existence. So I wanted my book to be like the doppelganger of Tamerlane. So I talked to a friend, Olivia Permanis, who's at the Harry Ransom Center, where they have one of those. She got it out of the vault and examined it, told me how many signatures and how many folios in each signature and how it was sewn and so forth. I looked at some examples of pamphlets from the era. I wanted it to be as much as possible like Tamerlane, but I also wanted it to open, and Tamerlane was was stab sewn, but I wanted mine to function. I've been really interested in the engineering aspects of the book the last few years, and I couldn't make something that wouldn't open. It was fun for the deluxe edition to use this historical structure that I learned from Jeff. I contacted a friend, Pamela Smith, a marbler in New Mexico, and said, do you have any paper that looks historically accurate to mid-19th century but is creepy? And she had something that was just right. So it was really fun to put together all those things that I've been interested in. The Night Sky books are satisfying in another way. Until I just went Codex a few years ago, I was really interested in something that would function as a sculpture, as a book you could read, and as something to play with. And I think those collections of hinged triangles do that. And at the same time, I think I was able to successfully weave together personal and historical content. I have a binding I like. Can I mention
that? Yeah, absolutely. Please.
So, because I knew you were going to ask this, so I thought that I should mention a binding. I bound a canticle for Leibowitz a few years ago. Do you know that story? So it's a classic of those Cold War post-apocalyptic science fiction novels where the world has been destroyed by some nuclear or something. And there are these monks that are copying these remaining documents over and over and over again. And each monk is able to work on a personal project. So the monk that we're following decides his personal project he's going to do is make an illuminated manuscript of this thing that they don't know what it is, but we would recognize it as a circuit diagram. So I used the late Coptic style to bind it. Because I've been fascinated, like growing up watching Star Trek and then all the later incarnations of that and things like that. There are these very advanced cultures that have all this incredible technology, yet they're wearing like raw animal skins and they're eating worms and stuff like that. So, again, kind of got this idea in my head that it would be the obvious thing to do to use this ancient bookbinding style, but have the design be a circuit diagram. So I've cold tooled on it what looks to me, with my limited understanding of engineering, as a stylized circuit diagram.
Changing the subject a little bit, in recent years you've become a regular on the workshop circuit teaching throughout the U.S. How would you describe...
And Canada.
And how would you describe your own training, and how has that affected your teaching style?
So my training has been primarily workshops, but lately some more, like those AAB classes are not like your typical entertaining weekend workshop. And I've worked really hard on my own also.
Right.
Which I think is the difference. I see a lot of people taking workshops and not making work on their own. I think the workshops is not enough. Well, it depends on what you want to do, you know? Like, I make a pretty good pie crust, but I don't presume to be a professional baker or chef.
No, but you make a lot of pies. So you're getting the repetition in making the crusts.
Exactly, yeah. I am aware when I teach that there are a lot of people in the classes that do a lot of workshops and may not do things at home and need the repetition. So there are a lot of things I stress, and I hope that they're thinking about what I'm doing instead of just watching what I'm doing and doing it. And even if I'm teaching a class on flag books, I might, you know, throughout the day, hold up the book and point to things and make them say spine, foredge, head, tail,
right.
You know, joint.
Teaching them that shared vocabulary.
Yeah, And the last time I was teaching something, it was kind of exciting. For the first time, I taught more than one person here in my home studio, and that was kind of a cool thing to do a workshop here. But I saw them sewing, and I suggested to them, you know, why don't you sew one hand inside, one hand outside, always like that. You don't need to stick your head around and look on the inside. You should be able to feel what you're doing. You don't need to pull the thread all the way every time just as you're bringing it out. And just things about efficiencies that I've learned. I guess there's kind of all these hard-fought things that I've learned, and things about the engineering of the book that I've tried so hard to learn, and with my workshop kind of education, there's just not time to talk about that.
Right.
I would like to pass these things on to... I try to teach them, in addition to whatever the subject at hand is, these other things that I found were very important that no one told me about, and I just kind of stumbled on.
And those things are sometimes some of the most valuable things that one can take back.
If, though, depending on where the person is, maybe it's not what they're interested in. So there's something interesting that's been happening. I have a student now.
Right.
Hadn't done any binding before she came to work with me. Well, she had, she watched this video by this guy, Larry, that either he's doing things in a really weird way, or he had to figure it out completely by himself and came up with the best he could, and it's quite admirable, depending on how you look at it. Anyway, she's only learned from me. She's not learned from anyone else. And I see her doing these little gestures, and I ask her, you know, why are you doing that? Who told you to do that? And she's mimicking what I do. And, boy, it's kind of weird to have it thrown back in your face like that. Though sometimes I see that she's doing something that's quite good.
Yeah. What do you see as some of the major challenges faced by those taking workshops and wanting to establish themselves as binders or book artists?
Well, the selling it is a whole different thing.
Right.
That may or may not have any relationship to...
Then let's backtrack. You know, what is the major challenge, you know, as they're taking workshops and they want to get out there?
They want to become skilled?
Yep.
Or they want to become known?
Both.
In terms of becoming skilled, then the work has to be done, like 80% of their work needs to be done doing it on their own and practice, and enough work on their own that when they go to a workshop, they will have a whole lot of questions, and what the instructor will say is not enough because they've been thinking at home, what about this, what about this, I have trouble with this.
Right.
Which isn't going to happen if you're just watching the instructor and doing what they tell you to do.
Right.
You know, it's got to be enough work that you start to wonder why. You know, why do I do this? Why isn't this working? To notice if something isn't working. In terms of getting known, that was part two?
Yeah.
Is there more of part one?
No.
Okay. So, I used to be a member of this women's cooperative gallery. And I, not book, just members worked in a variety of mediums. And I entered this organization through their mentorship program. So there were monthly workshops on, I don't know, writing an artist statement, photographing your artwork, approaching galleries, and so on. And as we went through the year with these workshops, we were planning our own show so that we could put together these practical things that we were learning and actually apply the skills. And when the person came to talk to us about PR, the person said, meet everyone you can. And it seemed really slimy to me. And, you know, people will say, oh, well, this person just gets these opportunities because they know all these people. Well, you know how hard it is to meet all those people? That's a skill, too. And
right.
To keep in touch with people. And if I'm curating a show, how can I, if sometimes I'm in the position of I'm the one that's doling out the opportunities, how can I dole out opportunities to people I don't know? especially if you're someone like me who's not been to art school, not working in an institution, doesn't have this built-in network of people, I would suggest that such a person get involved with something. The Guild of Book Workers, if there's some local book arts or art organization, something like PBI where there's 60 people and you're there with them for 2 weeks, so you can get some connections.
Right. And what kind of advice would you give people who are trying to establish themselves from a business standpoint?
Could you be more specific?
If I were to ask you and say, Karen, you know, I've been working really hard at this and I want to establish myself as a business person. I want to be successful at it and effectively make this my career. I mean, these are questions that I find myself getting asked occasionally. What would you say to people?
Well, in terms of a career, I think there needs to be some match with one's expectations and the reality. I'm not supporting myself.
Right.
I'm certainly not supporting myself doing this. I'm more than covering my costs. You know, in terms of rich and famous, maybe I have some advice with the famous. I don't have any advice with the rich part of it.
And that seems to be fairly common in our field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. First of all, like we talked about shows. You know,
right.
I don't know how effective Show in Your Work is if it's a show that doesn't get any publicity, if nobody knows about it. I've certainly known lots of people that are unhappy that they're not selling work, but they aren't doing anything to promote their work. So who's going to, you know, I'm looking out, as I talk to you, I'm looking out my window, out my backyard. I don't see anybody wandering around in the backyards in my neighborhood looking in windows thinking, is there a book artist in there? Do I see a studio in there? Are there artist books for sale in there?
Right.
You know, you need to, no one's going to be your advocate. Well, that's not true. You're my advocate.
But I think in general, you're right.
You need to be your biggest advocate in terms of promoting your work. And yes, it's uncomfortable. Every year when I send out my mailing, I get ready to put them in the mailbox, and I think, is this going to hurt my career more than it helps it? And I'm horrified. But
yeah.
It's uncomfortable. But ultimately, for me, it's not as uncomfortable as making this stuff and nobody knows about it. In terms of pricing, that part of the business thing, boy, it's something no one ever talks about. But there are many things to consider when you're setting your price. I'm pretty good at details, so I can be pretty petty when I come up with everything to include, but, you know, there's the cost of your materials. If your materials are mail order, there's the cost of the postage, too. There's when you send it wherever you have to send it, like sending it to my dealer, depending on who it is, I pay all or half that postage. Oh, there's a whole long list of things, but there. Your hourly rate, your time, you can't really charge for the time it came to come up with the piece because that would be...
That would be very difficult.
It would be a whole lot.
Right.
That $250 book would suddenly cost...
$2,000.
Yeah, $1,250.
Right.
But don't underprice your work.
So are there any final thoughts that you would like to share? I mean, is there anything that we haven't talked about but that's kind of burning to come out?
Boy, I don't know what to do with this, but somebody said something interesting to me when I was teaching a workshop a couple months ago that I've kind of been pondering. I was teaching that triangle book structure, and I don't know what the guy asked me, but I told him that lately I was just making codex-style things. Not these, I don't want to say more creative structures because I don't, you know, it's, whether it's creative or not is how you use it.
But the work is more conceptual.
I don't think that's true either.
Okay.
But, more sculptural.
Sure.
I wasn't doing that. Now I was just working with these more traditional forms. And the person kind of horrified said, why? And that was really disturbing to me. Just as I've become an advocate among book artists for traditional binding techniques and forms, you know, I would really like to be an advocate for the codex. You know, it's worked for all these years.
Right.
And, you know, maybe it's a more modest-looking thing, and you have to pick it up and open the pages and see what's in there. But you asked what's happening with interest in your work now that it's less flamboyant looking. And I worry about that, too. But that's what I'm drawn to making now.
Well, thank you very much.
Can we end cheery?
What?
Can we end cheery?
Well, I think I agree. I mean, the codex is it's a structure that many people have written off as being dead, and yet people still are drawn back to it. And I don't think that, you know, it's uncheery to end it that way. But I think the question, you know, out of the blue from this student, is thought-provoking, and I think you've been able to move between the non-traditional and the traditional fairly well, and it's becoming more and more fluid. So I think that's an advantage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just give these things that are a little more modest-looking a chance. You know, just because it doesn't look like a pineapple doesn't mean there's not something great inside there if you leaf through a few pages.
Right, and if you look at something like, let's say, the Poe or the Sloane, and the Sloane's Model Architect is, it's a traditional-looking book, but it uses the drumleaf binding structure, and that's fairly innovative. But it's this material, as Richard Minsky would say, it's this material meets metaphor kind of thing, where if you're trying to interpret something like Poe, it's really calling for a contemporary structure to be used, or at least to have the look and feel of that period, which then draws the reader into it a little bit more. That's what I feel. But I think it's been very good talking to you. I think you've had some very good thoughts to share, and thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Bye.